This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, June 20th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, what will the climate be like when today's college students are approaching retirement age? A new book out today wrestles with that question. We'll speak with the author. Getting the ground truth about severe weather. That's today's feature story from H2O Radio. And whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg died late last week. We'll revisit some of his comments to KGNU about the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons facility south of Boulder. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth? This week's science show will explore the history and persistence of race science with journalist authors Angela Saini and Ashley Smart. At 9 a.m. comes another archival recording of The Wit and Wisdom of Alan Watts. Then at 9:30, Terry Reardon will be in the Boulder studio for The Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first, it's time for the headlines with KGNU's John Kellen.
The unemployment rate in Colorado held at 2.8% from April to May. The Colorado Department of Labor and Employment says the number of people without jobs during that period was about 90,000, up slightly from the previous period. It's the 13th straight month that Colorado unemployment has been below 3%. Nationwide, unemployment increased from April to May to 3.7%. There are reports that Westminster-based Ball Corporation may be up for sale. KGNU's Steve Miller has the story.
Ball Corporation, the Westminster, Colorado-based company, and the world's largest supplier of beer cans, is looking at possibly selling off another division of their company that provides aerospace and national defense hardware for over $5 billion. Reuters reports that the divestment of the aerospace business, which accounted for 13% of Ball's net sales in 2022, would allow Ball to focus more on its beverage packaging operations and could also trim its debt pile of about $9.7 billion. Ball established its aerospace division in the 1950s, becoming a key contractor in areas such as earth science and national security. The business has attracted the interest of large defense companies such as BAE Systems and Textron, as well as private equity firms. Ball shares rose 7% to $58.57 in afternoon trading in New York on Friday, giving the company a market value of more than $18 billion. Because of the national holiday yesterday, the market was closed. For KGNU, I'm Steve Miller.
The city of Boulder is planning a controlled burn near Nederland this week. It could begin today, depending on weather conditions. Boulder Fire Rescue will supervise the slash burn with support from local fire departments. Smoke may be visible for several days and could pose health risks for some people, according to a city press release. The controlled burn will take place in the Silver Lake watershed area and is meant to reduce vegetation as part of fire risk management. According to the press release, the burn will start after 10 a.m. and end before 3 p.m. If weather conditions aren't favorable, the city says the burn will be delayed. Nearly 70 people living in a unique homeless shelter in Denver will be looking for a new place to stay once the facility closes this August. KGNU's Colette Zarnicki explains.
The former Roadway Inn houses women, transgendered, and non-binary people. The CEO of Gathering Place, the nonprofit which operates the shelter along with the Salvation Army, told the Denver Post over the last 3 years, private rooms have helped about 120 residents become independent. Shelter residents and the 30 staff members created a successful community that includes a makeshift library and meeting room that is supplied with face masks, books, and computers. Residents even have access to the opioid overdose antidote naloxone. But the building itself is dilapidated with maintenance and plumbing issues. According to Denver Post, Denver decided to sell the building over, quote, concerns about the property, leaving some of the residents with the possibility of ending up back on the street. The shelter is currently set to close on August 23rd. For KGNU, I'm Colette Zarnicki.
A state panel will meet tonight to consider whether certain locations and geographical features in Colorado should be renamed. Some of the possible changes under consideration by the Colorado Geographic Naming Advisory Board are renaming Redskin Mountain to Mount Jerome, Redskin Creek to Ute Creek in Park and Jefferson Counties, Negro Draw to Robinson Draw in Montezuma County, Chinaman Canyon to Toyson Canyon in Los Animas County, and Dead Mexican Gulch to Jose Bilardi Gulch in Garfield County. The board was established by Governor Jared Polis and will make its recommendations to him. Emergency rescuers in Boulder say there's been a noticeable increase in the number of Boulder Creek rescue calls they've had in the last few weeks. All that recent rain, coupled with mountain runoff from melting snow, has raised creek levels, which has it running faster. Boulder Fire Rescue has done at least 5 water rescues over a 2-week period, according to the Denver Gazette. Monday was the metro area's first 90-degree day since last summer. It hit 93 degrees in Denver. The National Weather Service says that today, morning clouds will give way to mostly sunny skies with high temperatures in the mid to upper 80s. In Denver, the high temperature should be 89 degrees. Look for a high of 85 in Boulder, 86 in Fort Collins, and in Nederland, expect a high of 71 degrees. For KGNU, I'm John Kellen.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Climate disaster zones may not be at the top of your list of destinations this summer, but you can let a book take you there. A Traveler's Guide to the End of the World, Tales of Fire, Wind, and Water debuts today, and its author, David Gessner, joins me live in the studio. Good morning.
Morning, Shannon.
So if folks are hearing this and thinking, if I want to go to the end of the world, where exactly are you going and why?
Well, I think in the beginning of the book, I say, come with me on a tour. And I say, believe it or not, we can have a little fun and we go to some beautiful places. But we also go to fragile places where climate change is not off in the future, but is happening now. And one of those places is Boulder, Colorado.
Right. We were just chatting right before we opened the mics that the last time you were here with me, you were presenting a Thoreau-inspired book about the natural world. And it was so smoky out that we couldn't even see the Flatiron. So why are you back to present your book here, which comes out today, here in Boulder on its release date?
Well, there were dual origins for the book. One was my daughter, who was a climate activist in high school, and who went through a high school where 2 of her terms were hurricane influenced, where her high school became a shelter and the rest were COVID. And she said, doom is normal. So I started to ask scientists what the world would be like when my daughter was my age, which is 2062. And the answers weren't pretty. But the other origin came here in Boulder, the first places I traveled after the pandemic and talked to you. And as you said, the sky was full of smoke. And I write in the book, I wanted to see where the smoke was coming from. So I did a pilgrimage to Paradise, California, where, of course, it had been ravaged 2 years before. But the new fire, the Dixie Fire, was coming in. And I spoke to people in diners, in bars. And one woman said to me, you know, people don't get that climate is a personal story. So it was a book of traveling to places and kind of being forced into writing the book. I didn't expect to write about climate. I visited Ken Slight, who some people might know as Seldom Seen Smith from the Monkey Wrench Gang. You know, he was a character in Ed Abbey's book. And his Quonset hut, where he kept all his memorabilia, his articles, his essays, his notes from traveling with Abbey, had been incinerated in the Pack Creek fire. I arrived 2 days later. We were at his wife's birthday party, heard a rumbling. And a flash flood was coming down like a freight train down the valley with trees and boulders. And it was like, holy crap, I think this is something I have to focus on. And of course, I live on the hurricane coast of Carolina, where we're always threatened, very similar to the West with fires.
Well, in your experience visiting these areas that have become even more prone to natural disasters due to climate change, were there any patterns that you saw emerging?
Yeah, you know, I've traveled through the Outer Banks for years now with a scientist named Oren Pilkey, and we've watched these storms as they push the banks back. And, you know, naturally an island will migrate toward the shore, but when you draw a line in the sand with trophy houses, it can't do that. So I found a real parallel between what's happening out here. you know, where fire season is, which is, of course, spread through the whole year, as we know from the most recent fire. But the apprehension about fires is similar to the apprehension about hurricanes where I live. So, you know, if you had a final four of climate disaster areas, we'd be in there, and maybe, you know, Phoenix would be meeting us in the finals.
You know, I kind of cringe when I hear the overuse of the term resilience when speaking about folks who have to constantly bounce back and rebuild from these disasters, because it really comes down to survival. So what kinds of survival skills did you learn about from those with lived experience in the process of writing this book?
Well, first, let me agree with you about cringing. one of the reasons I wrote the book is I was very tired of the tropes of hope, the tropes of disaster. I feel like climate writing is in a very immature stage, and that's part of the problem. Not just telling the story, which everybody talks about, but, you know, you don't read a novel looking for bullet points at the end, right? You don't, you know, I've done interviews with people who haven't read the book, and I'll say, it's not about policy, and this book isn't about hope. And there'll be a pause, and they'll say, what about hope? What about policy? You know, so I tried to kind of rip apart the cliches. There's humor in the book. There's me meeting people. And there is resilience. I'll give an example. Is Ryan Lambert, who lives in southern Louisiana, where the land is being, you know, as we know, famously, football fields going away per day. And he single-handedly with a grant from Ducks Unlimited, redirected part of the Mississippi, and the sediment rebuilt some of the land near his riding lodge. And the other moment of hope, I'm not hopeful, but I felt hope when I was up at the source of the Colorado, straddling the Colorado, the water lifeblood that gives 36 million people its water. And it was this beautiful swirling day. And I was like, nature is the source. Now, we might not recognize that, and it might not help us, but to me, it's still a hopeful thing.
Well, this book presentation tonight is special in that you are paying homage to one of your fellow writers, Mark Spitzer. Can you share a bit more about Mark Spitzer and the legacy that you'll be celebrating tonight at your event at 6:30?
My wife, Nina DeGramont, who's the author of The Christie Fair, is also going to talk. And we're both very good friends in the CU writing program in the early 90s with Mark. Mark came charging in, this dynamo of energy. He was kind of a nouveau beatnik. Kerouac was his hero. He'd always have an orange felt pen, and he'd write on his pants, and he'd write everywhere, and he was always writing books and traveling to Paris and back. And he really inspired me. I had been a perfectionist, kind of stiff and afraid to send my work out into the world, and I watched him and kind of was freed up by him. So and he had kind of a Harpo Marx hair and just this manic energy that was contagious. And we stayed close over the years, and we lived up off Lee Hill and what he called the Mountain Palace. It was just a little house. And he called my wife and her friend Melinda the Mountain Gals. And he called me Gruff Dave. And he just was this fiction writer all the time. So we stayed close over the years. And this year, and we were planning, these books came out at the same time. We were planning to tour together. But he died after a cancer diagnosis, as I think he was 56, so ridiculously young. And his wife / widow, Leah Graham, who's a poet, is coming tonight. And it should be a really wild night because we're going to combine things. It's my book launch, but that's minor compared to kind of this celebration of Mark. And his new book, Monster Fishing, is about crazy fish like gars, you know, leper fish, he calls them. But he sees something in their strangeness and their anti-societal fish, and he pursues them, and then he ultimately decides not to fish anymore. And, you know, it's classic Mark, and there's wacky humor in there, and we're going to celebrate him and take a little longer than a usual reading tonight because that's what we're there to do.
Again, that's going to be tonight at 6:30 at the Boulder Bookstore. In our final minute, I just want to ask, I mean, in your book, you bring a lot of humor to it, even though the subject matter is pretty grave. And also you're talking about celebrating a life that was lost. What is the importance of just having levity when processing heavy topics?
I think we just repress when it comes to this. There's a chapter called Beneath the Ice, and I think a lot's going on beneath the ice. We don't sit around and, you know, we're busy this morning. We're doing this interview. We're not sitting here thinking about our death or our doom or 50 years in the future. So humor is a way to kind of ease people in to like trying to say, how about we unrepress for a minute? How about we really do think about our children or their children? And if I can get them to a place where they're following me in these interesting roots, then I think I can bring them to really imagining what that world's going to be like 50 years from now. Will that do any good? I don't know, but I think it's important for us to do.
I've been speaking with author David Gessner. His brand new book released today is A Traveler's Guide to the End of the World, Tales of Fire, Wind, and Water. David, thanks so much for joining me in the studio this morning.
Thanks. See you in a couple of years. Hope it's not smoky.
Summer, and along with barbecues, beach days, and gardening, it's the time of year for severe storms. Although the National Weather Service has many forecasting tools at its disposal, there are blind spots where alerting the public about hazardous situations can be hard to achieve. That's where Skywarn comes in. H2O Radio's Franny Halperin has more.
When Paul Thompson was a child growing up outside Houston in the early 1980s, severe weather and hurricanes frightened him.
We had a lot of storms growing up in Houston, and the thunder and lightning kind of scared me a bit, especially at nighttime with all the bright flashes and the loud booms and stuff.
But fear gave way to fascination, and eventually weather became a hobby, because back then, when a hurricane was in the forecast, grocery stores would pass out maps to help residents follow a storm's path and prepare.
It was a large chart about the size of, I don't know, a few 2 by 3 feet or so. It had the whole Atlantic Basin and the Gulf of Mexico. And so you would tune into the nightly news and they would give you the latitude and longitude of the current storms and you would plot it on your map.
How would you plot it? Just with a pen?
Yeah, pen or pencil. Yeah, just mark it down, just very analog.
These days, meteorologists have digital tools and radar to help with forecasting. But even with modern technology, a lot of places can be off the radar. And that's where people like Paul, who now lives just outside Denver, comes in. He recently trained to become a severe weather spotter for the National Weather Service Skywarn program.
Skywarn is like a voluntary network of weather enthusiasts. And once you take the class, you're assigned a spotter number. So if you need to report a sighting of anything like a tornado or certain hail sizes, they use your number to correspond with you and your location.
Paul, who I can now refer to as Spotter AD 1134, is one of 10,000 spotters. Yes, 10,000 in Northeast Colorado alone. Spotters are in every state and become an extra source of information for the Weather Service. Extra eyes on the sky, they like to say.
So we have a lot of great science and technology at the weather office with radar, satellite, observations, but we're always missing that kind of one component, kind of that ground truth.
That's meteorologist Scott Entrekin with the National Weather Service Boulder office that covers Northeast Colorado. I'm at one of the Skywarn classes he teaches every spring to train new recruits.
Bottom line, our mission here in the National Weather Service is the protection of life and property. This is one of the reasons why we go out and train the public for you guys to be ready.
Students at tonight's 2-hour class in Denver are learning about storm structure, cloud features, and how to tell if a storm is strengthening and possibly developing into a tornado so they can relay information back to the Weather Service.
We got a lot of hazards with thunderstorms that we'll go through this evening, whether it be tornadoes, hail, lightning, wind, and flooding. We can get them all.
Folks on the ground are able to tell us specifically how big the hail is. Do they see a tornado or not? So there are all those things that can fill in that kind of the piece of the puzzle that we might be missing.
The spotters working with the Boulder office are mostly concentrated along the Front Range from Denver up to Fort Collins. But numbers dwindle as you get out on the eastern plains, so Scott and his colleagues rely on people like Dakota McGee.
So I'm Dakota McGee. I'm from Iliff, Colorado, northeastern Colorado. I'm a big weather enthusiast. It's a big hobby of mine as a spotter and chaser. I've taken quite a bit of their Skyward courses. I want to say I've probably been to at least 10 or 12 of them over the last 6-7 years.
I've met up with Dakota, who is in his late 20s, and arrived in a car adorned with Storm Chaser decals in Fort Morgan, a ranching and farming community about 80 miles northeast of Denver. To my disappointment and, honestly, relief, the skies are blue with puffy white clouds to the west. But Dakota says, don't be fooled, those clouds look promising.
So what we got all around us is cumulus clouds, which is your basic cloud that will turn thunderstorms into thunderstorms. As moisture increases, it'll build, and kind of become those big cauliflower-like clouds. I mean, these ones right here are just getting started.
But he doesn't just look at the horizon to decide if it's going to be a so-called chase day. In the morning, he'll look at atmospheric conditions like dew points and moisture, and he'll also consult university and storm prediction center models.
Once I look at the models and pick a target, you know, try to get out there, usually an hour, maybe 2 hours ahead of when they're supposed to fire.
If his calculations pay off and he catches a storm, he'll report what he finds from hailstones to wind speed to the National Weather Service, and if need be, they'll issue warnings. But they may also call him. He shows me an app on his phone where a beacon will tell the Weather Service if he's near a severe storm.
And the National Weather Service can see these, and they are curious what's going on, and they see a spotter like mine, they can call me.
In 2022, he recorded Colorado's first tornado of the year, and they called asking him what he saw. Bagging a tornado can be exhilarating, and chasing generally can be intense, like a few weeks ago when he got pelted with tennis ball-sized hail. Also, the sport, as some are calling it now, is getting crowded, which can make for dangerous situations on small country roads when hundreds of people are in pursuit of a storm, some without enough experience. So, for folks who want to chase, Dakota has some advice.
All for it, you know, just I suggest be safe and be ready for a chaotic mess at times.
Right.
But I think it's just better if you want to start out chasing, definitely go take the classes, Skywarn classes from the National Weather Service.
And in addition to Skywarn training, he says start by going out with a seasoned chaser to get your feet wet. Bottom line for him as a spotter helping the National Weather Service in its mission to protect the public, you have to protect yourself first. For H2O Radio in Denver, Colorado, I'm Franny Halperin.
Daniel Ellsberg, the whistleblower who leaked the Pentagon Papers, died Friday at the age of 92. In 1971, while working as a military analyst, Ellsberg leaked the papers to the New York Times, revealing the extent of the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. He continued to speak out against war and protested the manufacturing of nuclear weapons at the Rocky Flats Nuclear Weapons Facility south of Boulder. At a 2018 event for KGNU, Ellsberg spoke via Skype to an audience in Boulder, commemorating the protests. He recalled going to the plant in 1978.
There was a good deal of protest against the idea of the neutron bomb, which, by the way, was going to have its main components, plutonium components, machined at Rocky Flats. And that's why I had accepted in advance to speak at Rocky Flats on the assembly that and civil disobedience that was planned for April 29th.
The protesters, known as the Rocky Flats Truth Force, set up camp April 29, 1978, but several of them, including Ellsberg and his son Robert, were arrested on May 8th for blocking the railway tracks going into the plant.
And as my son and I in handcuffs are traveling now to Jefferson County Jail, past the tracks, which my son was seeing for the first time, and he said to me, handcuffed to me, you know, There should have been people on the tracks in Auschwitz.
Ellsberg was arrested four times in 1978 for protesting at Rocky Flats. He and the other protesters were convicted of trespass for blocking trains.
I remember the editorial at the end of our trial saying, whatever you think of these protesters' actions, what they are asking is correct. Rocky Flats must close. Well, it took another 10 years for that to happen. And these actions may or may not, and I would have said, have been the seed for that later closing, which happened in particular as a result of leaks, that is, unauthorized disclosures by internal, one in particular, employees of the plant.
Rocky Flats was formally shut down in 1992. Daniel Ellsberg died at his home in California on June 16th of 2023. That's it for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host and producer, Shannon Young. Thanks to John Kellen, Colette Sarnicki, Steve Miller, Jacob Agatston, Alexis Kenyon, Franny Halperin, and Maeve Conran for their work on today's program. Stay tuned for How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. That's coming up after the BBC News headlines.